Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the House of 1229. What do you think? You're only like, I don't know, 500 to the 500, I don't know, 50th people that have been here. David Urban said earlier that he tried to buy the house years ago. And by the way, we're so glad. There's Kathleen Buell. She put this together. Kathleen, thank you for doing this. To Women's Leadership Club, and thank you for joining us at the Washington AI Network. It's a special night, as you all know, because you're so enthusiastic, because General Catalyst is in the house. Let's hear it for them. How great is that? Paul Kwan, Managing Director. You guys know him. Let's hear it for him. Okay. And Washington's own Teresa Carlson. And for those who don't know well, I'm going to give you a little background. Paul is a Stanford-trained computer scientist where he currently teaches a class on national security and tech innovation. At General Catalyst, he leads the Global Resilience Team. Before GC, he spent 22 years at Morgan Stanley's tech banking effort on a global basis. I think it's a good idea that he's a General Catalyst, no longer at Morgan Stanley. Do you guys agree? That was a good move. It's so great to have you here. And as many of you know, Teresa Carlson. Teresa's a longtime colleague and friend. She spent most of her career at big tech companies, Amazon and Microsoft, a long, long time Washingtonian. She founded and led AWS's worldwide public sector. We call her the cloud queen here. And she really did lead that whole seismic shift to the cloud computing for business and mission capabilities. Before that, she led the U.S. federal government at Microsoft. And in 2022, she went back to Microsoft. They always pull you back, don't they? They try. SVP and executive in residence, which, by the way, sounds like fun. Did you do a lot of work? Were you at the pool? All right, good. Okay. But then she went to Splunk, where she had to work really hard in Flexport. And this is a really exciting night because Teresa is now working with Paul and General Catalyst as their newest advisor. How great is that? And it's so great. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. Now, Paul, I want to start with you. Tell me about your thesis on global resilience.
First of all, Tammy, thanks to you and your team for putting on this amazing event and for everyone come out in the rain. We couldn't bring the West Coast weather out. Unfortunately, yesterday was pretty nice, that we saw. But no, global resilience at GC has been kind of a 20-year project in the making. It's really about modernizing our most critical infrastructure systems, whether that's defense and intelligence, industrial or energy. We have a different approach to solving those problems, which we'll talk about. And we first started about 20 years ago. We bought a company called BBN at GC, which was a kind of famous defense integrator, not the typical thing a VC firm would do. And we had some good success there, but it's been a nice journey. We'll talk more about the companies we've involved in Anduril. Matt Steckman, we were the second check there. But it's really about how do we modernize these really hard industries in partnership with you all.
So, Teresa, how do you look at this kind of investment?
Well, I hadn't really spent much time with General Catalyst, and I'd been around a lot of venture capital groups, and I got to know Paul. He'd been at Morgan Stanley. Anybody who knows any transactions in tech, they were driven by Paul. Like, he was kind of an icon in that industry. And as I got to know he and Hema, the one thing that struck me that was really interesting was mission. And I've spent most of my career, even though I actually have not been in government, I've spent most of my career making sure that everything I was doing was driving innovation and mission to government. And that was really, I mean, truly, truly a passion for me. And as I got to talking to GC and Paul, he said, we've created this global resilience group and we are doing it on a global basis, but we are really focused on how do we help governments around the world with getting tech in an innovation in there. And I was like, really? That's what I've been doing, but in a very different way. So it just really made a lot of sense. So for government itself, Tammy, the thing that's really important is government needs access. They need to understand what's out there. They need to be able to try technologies and experiment as quickly as possible. They don't need to be buying large quantities of things that they can't actually utilize. And why this is an important mission is we've we've got to get more technology in the hands of government at a commercialized level so they can move much faster. And some of the things that I've been told over the years from government leaders is, it's not that we don't have the most amazing technical and business leaders in government and mission leaders. We just can't move as fast as commercial can today because of a variety of reasons, acquisition, just movement of budget. So they need to absorb commerciality, and that's exactly what we're doing at General Catalyst.
Is that what radical collaboration is? Because this is Washington, and we're not that good at that stuff.
Well, we'll see. I mean, we'll talk about it a bit later. But, you know, the work we've done around healthcare has really informed our approach, right? So in healthcare, just to tell you a quick story at General Catalyst, you know, over the last maybe 7 years, we've made a dent in transforming that sector. We learned really four things. One is, transforming hard industries takes a lot of capital. It takes a different horizon, a different duration for how long it takes. It takes radical collaboration with the existing ecosystem. We never say the word disrupt. It's all in transformation with government, with incumbents. And fourthly, it takes creativity of approach. There aren't a lot of companies that are scaled up solving these problems for obvious reasons. So sometimes you have to start your own company. Sometimes you have to buy companies. Sometimes you have to roll up companies. And so those lessons we learned in healthcare, we've done 125 companies in healthcare. General Catalyst is touching about 15% of U.S. healthcare population through our portfolio. We're actually going to go buy a hospital system. Who would have thought a venture capital firm would buy a hospital system? Crazy stuff. We can talk more about that. Glenn Tullman at Livongo has been amazing at that, and Hamant and team. But it's really, how do you take those elements to now defense and industrial and energy? And so for us, radical collaboration is this room. It's how do you, to be very, very candid, the first thing, Lieutenant General retired Scott Howell, who's another key advisor. So Scott was the Scott was a JSOC commander 2018, 2021. And Teresa taught me was, you know, if you go to DC as a Silicon Valley VC, a technologist, you have to engage with complete humility and respect. And you have to constantly do that, right? So that's one part of it. But two, we do think radical collaboration, Tammy, is the recipe for success, and we've seen it in healthcare already.
And can I just say on that, Tammy, it is true. It's about partnership with government. It's not about going in and shoving your ideas out them. It's really about going in and listening to them and really understanding what are the issues you're facing and then come to them with an innovative idea. And I know we don't like to use innovation, but sometimes it's that collaboration on ideation of something. And the other thing that's very different, which people don't talk about very much when you're working with government, it's about coopetition. You have to be able and prepared to work with lots of different groups, because if you are not able to work with lots of different groups and partners across government, you're probably not going to be successful. And the reason that is government's already invested in a lot of things. So integration of the systems that they have and movement of that data is super important for government to be really successful, because they don't have time to start from scratch. I mean, they really have to take advantage of what they have in place and over time make those moves. But with cloud and AI new innovations that have come into government, access to them now, they can really move much faster with this.
Well, this is for both of you. Where do you both see the best opportunity now with global resilience?
So I think in defense and intelligence, you know, we kind of think about the multidimensional, you know, battlefield, right? Whether that's, you know, land, sea, air, that's cyber warfare, that's supply chain, that's information warfare, and it's space. And so you think about those areas, you think about all the capabilities you need to operationalize and just run teams and people, right? Just the ongoing, you know, software as a percent of DoD budget is, you know, whatever. It's a third, a quarter, a fifth of what it could be compared to other major industries, right? Software spending on CapEx for financial services, retail, name your energy, compared to what it is here, it's just too low. And so how do you transform there? So that's an area we spend a lot of time in, the industrial base. So, you know, we've got an amazing team working on how do we figure out the different parts of the industrial value chain, what can be leveraged with software, what can we make better, more effectively. We're not afraid of hardware. We're not afraid of making things. A lot of VCs are scared of hardware, scared of making physical things. We do a number of interesting companies there. We've got an interesting company in the audience that's going to make aerospace components for us.
Why aren't you guys afraid of it?
Because if you position it the right way, you can create a valuable business, which is relevant for the investors, but also can be seen as a technology company. You think about like a company like Tesla, that's a hardware company, it's a software company masquerading as a hardware company. We have a company called Samsara, which is not as well known, but it's an amazing industrial IoT logistics company. And for many, many years, people thought it was a camera company. You put a camera on a truck. The company actually started by putting a camera on an ice cream truck in San Francisco 5-6 years ago. It is now the fastest growing in enterprise software, trades at the highest multiple of any software company. And so that's where you can use hardware to accomplish your objectives. So again, you just have, it's back to creativity of approach. You can't just use the same playbooks that typical VCs do to help innovate and transform.
Teresa?
Well, and I was going to say, things have changed a lot since the Ukrainian war. I mean, it's changed a lot. We didn't know that we would be fighting battles with drones. We now know that 90% of drones are made in China. We know that over 85% of police departments are using Chinese drones. So we need more American-made. All things we need, you know, the CHIPS Act is a really big deal for us. Like, even just to start having a discussion on these things, we may not always agree everything that are put in the executive orders, but we need to be having the discussion and dialogue. So anything at the edge, I think anything easily deployable for mission capabilities is super important for us. We need to get technology in the hands of our infantry officers, the ones that are out there every day, our analysts, so they can make decisions much faster. If you think of, how do we make chips today? They're too big, they're too clunky, they're too expensive. So we have lots of opportunity right now to change the way we're doing things and get that in the hands of lots of different industries, by the way, that are trickling down very quickly into our defense base, our intel base, which we need desperately, and we cannot be behind China at this point. We need to move much faster as America.
So the war in Ukraine and now Israel, has that changed the opportunity here or how you're doing things?
Yeah, I think unfortunately, obviously, it exacerbates things and makes things more critical. We have a company called Helsing in Europe, which got to a program of record within 2 years and 2 months from the founding of the company. It's a different story, but clearly the urgency in Ukraine is driving some of that need. I would kind of shift the geopolitical thing to a slightly more sanguine, optimistic note. So we get asked a lot, like, why now? And it is geopolitical, but the other why now is that the kinds of people we see coming to solve these problems is very, very interesting. You're seeing, really, for the first time in my career in innovation, you're seeing tech entrepreneurs, tech engineers, tech startup people saying, I want to work on meaningful problems, and I want to work on national security-related things. That has never really happened before in mass. And then you have a number of people coming out of service who have a deep understanding of the mission. You know, some of them have, you know, business degrees, some of them intern at various companies, and so you're mixing
that. No one in this room.
You know, I'm looking at one of them on my team. I got one, the Harvard MBA dev group. And then you see the capital sources. And so really, the kinds of founders, the kinds of people we're working with, you know, not unlike, you know, Cameron, who'll be up here in a second, like, these are people who can build for the mission. They understand the mission. They have the right training in tech. And I think that's unique, Tim, in terms of getting great people. You need great people. I mean, this is not easy. You need great people who understand the mission and understand how to sell into this challenging ecosystem.
And can I go back for a minute? So when I was at Amazon, Andy Jassy always said, we're never going to forget the individual developers and the startups. And every business unit we had a startup business unit. We had it in mine, in government, in education, and we had it in finance and telco. No matter where we were around the world, we remembered startups because we saw what they were doing was unbelievable. And I learned so many lessons from the entrepreneurs that were just creating and seeing the use of cloud computing as a way to create. And the reason I think I'm super excited about now, because finally for me, seeing cloud is there. It's being represented both by Amazon, Microsoft, Google, and others who have created an opportunity for these companies to build their solutions and move so much faster than we ever dreamed. And it's a reality now. So why now? We have the platforms in place. We have a very motivated customer base, right? We have a defense is actually very stable. Intel, one of my greatest, some of my friends here, oh my God, thank you, doing amazing things in defense and Intel. Stable, reliable partners that need the technology. And guess what? You have a lot of funding. Like GC, there's lots of capital out there. And I won't go through, I just went and looked at some statistics. Financial Times and Wall Street Journal had two kind of different numbers, but Crunchbase and PitchBook both talked about the number of defense companies that have been created just in the last year. Like there's numbers from 450 to 500 with billions, over 17 billion that's being created in terms of what is being funded. Now that's a combination of just not cyber and cyber, but you're talking about billions of dollars now that are being invested. And all of a sudden, it's nice because people have woken up and said, hey, this is a fantastic opportunity to create new businesses for government. So I'm kind of excited. And the last thing I'll say, you gotta make sure they're also commercially available. You don't wanna just create something that's generally only government. You've gotta make sure that there's commercial viability for it outside of government. That's important because you don't want it to be too narrow.
Thank you so much, Teresa. Let's hear it for Teresa. Paul, will you stay with me? And we're gonna meet some of the companies.
So we're going to switch to the innovation conversation now.
This is about innovation. We've got some great panelists here. George Barnes, who's here with us right here. Let's give him a round of applause, formerly with the NSA, now General Catalyst. Matt Steckman from Anduril. Matt, so welcome, welcome. Good to see you. Cameron McCord, CEO of a new startup, very mysterious. And we're going to call a few people in the audience. So get you guys, please get your questions ready. George, we want to start with you. Talk about the transition, actually, because it isn't that long ago that you left government and you're now in the private sector.
All right. So
how's it gone?
It's going great. I'm here. So the big deal for me is connecting innovation to purpose. And so I've done that my whole life in the government, 37 years, National Security Agency. But what that always did for me is connected me to the innovation spirit of the country. And so I was always connected to companies. I was connected to bleeding edge technology and the art of the possible that our country presents that no other can. And so my ideal is to learn the other side of that. And so I'm going to the industrial base now, but with the same premise that we're all here to make our country great, to sustain what we've created, and not only for ourselves, but to set a symbol for the liberal democracies that are around the world fighting the good fight. The neat thing is, to the points that were raised before, there's a lot of imagination, there's a lot of creativity, and this is a time where we as a nation need to bring that to bear for things that matter. And so I'm all about that. It's been my life. I'm doing it from a different vantage point now. I'm just joining up with Grant and Paul and some others to really try to bring the innovation spirit rapidly to accelerated purpose. So,
George, being a little modest, so he's working at Red Cell with Grant and David and Brian, and so really one of the most innovative early stage defense tech, health tech firms we've seen in our ecosystem, and have built some really amazing companies and deliver capability in a really rapid time frame.
Okay, next we have Cameron. You have a unique background. I must say, you're the first fast attack submarine officer that's ever been here at the House of 1229. Can we give him a round of applause? And then you led the teams at Anduril and Saildrone. Can you talk about what you've done and this transition?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Thanks, everyone. It's great to be here. We're still keeping pretty quiet about the company that we're building, but I guess I'd share two observations that are kind of motivating what we're doing, and I think they're very serious observations. One is the amount of talent, venture capital dollars, focus that has gone into companies that are building, you know, data management organization systems and tools in the last 6, 8, 10, 12 years that are focused on everything but, I think, in my opinion, things that really, really matter has been incredibly high. And the amount of attention that's been focused on the industrial sector, aerospace, defense has been low. And I think that needs to change very, very significantly. And so that's one observation. And then as As Tammy said, experience working at Anduril in some of the earlier days, and at a company called SailDrone, and working at Lux Capital, observing companies in industrials, robotics, aerospace. The second observation is as these complex systems become more software-defined, software connected, autonomous, robotic, the amount that needs to go into verifying and validating and sort of testing and evaluating these systems is increasing at a very rapid rate, and it's becoming a defining capability and a competitive advantage for commercial companies. And so that is showing a little bit about what we do, both on the commercial side, providing software solutions that help manage the data that these complex systems generate as you're trying to verify and validate them, and then working with the Department of Defense as well. So
Matt, you know, I think Anduril is getting, you know, a lot more press and coverage now. I think what's not as well known about Anduril is the amount of investment we make on our own dollars, right? The R&D spending, we spend almost as much, every dollar coming in, almost as much as we spend on R&D to build capabilities ahead of requirements, ahead of customer demand. Maybe just talk about the business model of Anduril, you know, the scale and scope of what we're investing in to deliver capability.
Sure. Well, first, thanks for General Catalyst to putting this on. You guys were one of the first in, and that was not when defense investing was cool, and y'all took a bet on us.
No, big essay on just war theory and all this other stuff.
I just got my voice back yesterday. I think I had the plague last week. So hopefully I have this top shelf club soda, and it will keep me strong throughout this. At Anduril, we kind of, when we started the company, we knew we needed to do a couple things right off the bat. First, we knew we had to go right at what the primes were, sort of had the greatest lock on. The vast majority of money in the federal government is basically, it's already spent on day one whenever the budgets are approved, which was always a fun game. And so we knew we had to go after large programs that would make the top five, six, if you want to include L3 now, very nervous to see us. And when we started the company, everybody kind of like laughed at us, like, who would ever try and start a company to do this? There's so many barriers to entry, you're insane. That's basically what everybody told us. We're six, almost 7 years in. You know, I would say in a handful of cases, it's us versus the bigs. We're a 2,500 person company. Lots of backing, lots of momentum, but we are still exceptionally small as compared to Lockheed and Northrop and Boeing, and you guys know all these companies. I would say we're not going to win all of these competitions that we're in. You only have to win a few in order to become a pretty major player in the defense world. My other observation, though, maybe more importantly, is because we are in the competition in the first place, it is forcing those older companies to improve and sharpen their pencils and be better and move faster. And so even if I lose, I feel like everybody in this room wins. And so when we started the company, going big and going wide were two of the things we knew we were going to need to do. And that's a scary thing for investors. It's a scary thing for founders, because we have to, effectively at Anduril, we run 16 separate businesses right now, and we're 6 years old. And that's because that's what you have to do to make it in defense. It's a hedge play. It's a wide play. It's a big play. It takes a crazy amount of capital to put into place, a crazy amount of risk taking. And if it works more often than not, you can really move the needle. And I think we're starting to, which is
exciting. Of those 16, you know, some are profitable, some are moonshot investments, some are turning the corner. And so really that portfolio, but that's the level of scale it takes to, you know, deliver innovation. You know, George, I just want to talk about, you know, radical collaboration. I think it's something, you know, Red Cell and GC believe a lot in. Talk about what radical collaboration looks like in actually building, you know, a defense tech startup. Like some,
I think the key is the multidisciplinary integration. So actually having the technologist side saddle with the customer set, so you really understand the problem you're trying to solve. So you don't hypothesize or look at requirements documents. It's iterative, fast turn, collaborative development with short deliveries, so you can fine tune and then scale, and then picking use cases that are germane to the problem at hand, but also with a mind for their applicability in a much broader, scalable fashion. And so that tight loop of the different disciplines come together is, I think, what makes success. And that's what's different from the traditional acquisition model, where you have very staid documents going back and forth and transactional relationships. Today needs fast. Technology is moving too fast for what typical acquisition norms have been. And so I think the art of the possible has been proven by the outside, and in some small scales it's brought into the government, but we need to rapidly expand on that.
I was going to actually ask Sue Gordon if you would step in and say a few words. Look at her. She's like, there we go. There's Mike. Let's hear it for Sue Gordon, please. Thank you. Sue's like, no wonder I got the chair in the front. Ah, fortunately, you can handle it.
My keen analytic skills have failed me. Yeah. I should have said, so a few words on
transformation. I mean, what do you think happening? What are the opportunities now?
Oh, so I totally agree that the opportunities are resplendent. This is a moment of strategic uncertainty. So this is your favorite zoologist talking about a biologic term, which means we don't know what life is going to look like and that this moment. And so I guess it's daunting, but it's way more opportunistic because so much of the bedrock has shaken, and so there's opportunity. So that's one. Two is, I love a lot of things that are being said here. There are three really interesting conditions in the world right now. Number one is every technology is available to everyone. And so the one that puts it to clever use fastest is going to win. And so I hear a lot of words about the use of technology. We don't have a technology problem. We have a technology use problem. The government is challenged on that front because they have tactical needs that they tend to overemphasize at the expense of strategic gain. So some of the things you were saying, George, you know I agree with, because it isn't just about the technology we can develop to solve a small problem. It really is a bit about those advances that will make a difference in our overall abilities. So I think that's right. The other thing, in a digitally connected world, the national security decision makers are disproportionately not in the government. And if we in the private sector are waiting for the government to be good until we do the things that we need to do, so throwing technologies over the transom, expecting the government to do all the work of integration, about expecting them to see the use case rather than saying, instead of doing the presentation on the coolness of your technology, we count on it being cool. Talk to me about how it can be used. Those are the sorts of things that I think we can do to help that adoption, because to help them see how it can be used, what problem it can solve. You know, Jen, anytime you see you one, I'm super happy just because the room got better. But two, I was at RSA this year, 3,300 cybersecurity companies. How in the world is anyone supposed to know which one of those is going to make a difference? And all of them are good and none of them are enough. And so I think our collective mission, and Paul, I think when you talk about what GC is trying to do, it is trying to do that job. And then one more thing, you know, when I think about the work Teresa did with the CIA, with this brilliant moment of taking a chance on a technology that no one knew what to do with, and what happened as a collective, Amazon knew it had a good idea, but didn't know what it needed to be. And the government knew it had a problem, but didn't know what it could do. And as a result, the rest of the world is more secure and more able because those two came together. But other than that, I've got nothing.
Amazing, Sue. Where's Jeff from Hidden Level? When you come up, I think there's, you know, you don't need a, you know, multiple billions like Anduril do a capability to the warfighter. I think what they've done in a space
It doesn't
space
hurt
that,
though, Paul. It doesn't hurt.
No, I'm trying to, you're always selling, Matt. Always selling, right? But I think what they've done with Hidden Level and just kind of like the innovation and capability has been pretty amazing. So Jeff, kind of a quick intro and what you guys have been done on in pretty rapid time.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. It's great. So Hidden Level, we focused on advanced phased array technology for RF sensing basically have combined our heritage in electronic warfare and radar for a focus on spectrum dominance and air surveillance superiority. And then we enable our customers through a different unique business model through a data as a service and an infrastructure play that we own. And then we also sell that tech, take advantage of commercial procurement to put it into the warfighter's hand faster.
I'm going to summarize. Don't cut you off, Jeff. I'm going to summarize for the broader audience for the podcast. So Jeff and his team, Jeff and his team, on their own dime, put up 4 antennas in D.C.?
Six
antennas.
Without telling anybody.
They spent almost $1 million their own capital, and when they went up, they immediately saw dozens of nation-state enemy drones flying around doing stuff they probably shouldn't be doing. So
yeah, it's been fun. We freaked a few people out, but it's good stuff.
Are they up there now?
Actually, one was just flying in California a minute ago, so I get texts on this all the time. It's fun to see all the things. Most are Chinese drones. Yeah, mostly what you see are modified or just hobby Chinese drones, which are, as you were saying earlier, 98% of the threat.
Awesome. Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. We have James Roscoe, Deputy Chief of Mission at the British Embassy. James, good to see you.
Great to see you, Sammy, and thanks for having us, as ever, for these fascinating conversations, and thank you all for coming to talk to us. I was struck by something that George said, which was about essentially being on the front line of something here, a front line where we're standing up for and defending a set of values against an adversary. And there's a really fascinating guy in Ukraine who's called Vice Prime Minister Fedorov, who runs all of their tech and cyber activity. And he said, one of the great things for him right now is that every single Ukrainian who cares about Ukraine, who knows about these issues, wants to work for him. And they're on the front line of their cyber defense and their cyber attack. There are a lot of people in both our countries, I'm from the UK, who want to go and work for YouTube or X or some other company. What is it that motivates people to come and work for you? I'm conscious we have an adversary. I won't name them, but they have people at Beijing Dashui and Tianjin, for example, who they can recruit instantly and force to come and do this work. How do you get people who are at the cutting edge of what you do to come and work for you? And to what extent are they beginning to be motivated by potentially being on the front line of something?
So I'll start. So the magical formula, and we were just, Arun and I was just talking earlier, is purpose, right? And so different generations have different expectations. Some want money, some want flexibility. All of them want to work from home. Most can't. But purpose drives people, right? And so giving people purpose, supporting them in mastering their skills, giving them autonomy and delegated authority to work within their lanes, to drive toward the purpose that they're focused on, that creates magic, right? And so kids coming out of school today are searching for purpose differently than the kids the generation before them, which were more motivated differently. And so we have to latch on to that. We have to leverage it in. We have to make it seat. And we have to create the culture that supports those different drivers that are motivating them to stay in government and also to work for things that support our collective needs, even out of government.
I think this is the biggest change. I did another podcast recently, not yours, Tammy.
And not Kara's?
Not Kara's, maybe one day. And the single biggest driver, we believe, of value creation for companies will be culture. It used to be product and technology. Then it became go-to-market. Then it became culture, if you look at the history of tech companies. And now we believe purpose, mission, will drive that going forward.
Yeah. So first, really well said. I would add that the traditional companies providing technology to the national security community don't offer any of that, right? And so a big part of the founders in the room, our jobs is to start a new breed of cat, basically, right? How do you start a company that looks and feels and acts and treats employees differently, but is focusing that talent on the challenges that you and lots of the folks in the room deal with every day. Certainly in Anduril, and I'm sure for other founders in the room, we think about this stuff daily, right? What is helping us to recruit and retain and keep happy and build the best technology? It's all part of it.
And yeah, I could not agree more with the the previous comments, and I think I'd add, not only is it the mission set, but I think it's still, I think it has always been true, but it certainly remains true now, that the most interesting problems in the world to solve are national security related or adjacent. And so we are a young company. We deal with a lot of high scale, complex data, time series data. We pulled incredible engineers, some of the best engineers in the world, from the financial sector. Jane Street, Hudson River Trading, people that work in sort of these sectors, and just exposing them to, you know, the software engineering is similar, surprisingly so, but exposing them to, do you want to build something that helps people build drones or rockets or hypersonics or, you know, robotic systems? And I think their eyes light up when they realize that they can actually have a massive impact there, and the problems are just frankly like much, much more interesting. So I think that's a big piece of it as well.
So I want to go to Biz from Shield AI, and I think one of the things we're really focused on is radical collaboration, is that we think innovators can partner successfully with the primes, with the established ecosystem. This is what Helsing did in Europe. They partnered with Saab, got that capability in 2 years and 2 months, and so that's one of the hallmarks of your approach on some of your projects, not to mention your giant New York Times story.
Yes, the New York Times story was fun. And I'm glad it kind of all came out at the same time, too, with the round and everything. But yeah, I used to work at Raytheon. I had a couple years doing contract negotiations there for radar programs. And there, the problems that Raytheon faced were, you know, easily solved, could have been easily solved at that time when I was there by companies like Shield AI. And it was kind of when I was leaving Raytheon that I realized that there were all of these companies that were popping up, Anduril, Shield. Obviously, Palantir had been around for a while at that point, but they can help each other out in a lot of ways. They can bridge gaps. They can build capabilities that you know, each side can't really do. And so I think being at Shield, we've been very kind of focused, I guess, on you know, we make AI pilots. We're going to go down this one kind of swim lane, and we're going to help as many people as we can figure out how to deploy that. And so that's our example. But working with Kratos, with Boeing, with as many primes as we can get, I think that's the way to scale the impact that we have chosen to scale in this industry. And I think, you know, it's really awesome to be in a room like this because I think, you know, we're all bought into the mission and to, you know, these are life-changing, these are world-changing problems that everyone in here is solving. And the question is, how do you choose which problem to solve? Which if you're a founder, like you have to make that decision. If you're, you know, anyone else, if you're a VC, if you're at any one of these companies or in the government, that's what the problem is. And so primes, startups, everyone in the middle, you can solve all of them if you work together.
Biz, thank you so much. And thank you to the panel. And let's resolve more world problems in the other room and have another drink. Thank you everyone for joining us. And special thanks to each of our guests and to our partners, Paul Kwan and Teresa Carlson from General Catalyst. Be sure to visit our website and join the conversation online. Follow us on Threads, X, Instagram, and subscribe to our podcast. For the Washington AI Network, I'm Tammy Haddad. Thank you for listening.